Americans, and you're alive. Armed Forces Radio brings you a special rebroadcast with Victor Young and the orchestra, the Ken Darby Singers, John Nesbitt, and America's beloved baritone, John Charles Thomas.
Hello, dear friends, this is John Charles Thomas. Well, here we are again with another half hour of song, story, and music for you men and women in the armed forces of the United Nations. For story, we have John Nesbitt, one of America's best. For music, there's Victor Young and the orchestra. And for song, the Ken Darby Chorus and myself. And now, Vic, with the preliminaries over, let's get started. To start with today, I shall sing a song which has been a living part of fine musical literature for over 200 years. Handel's Largo.
Grandi tenere, che belle, che il mio plato. Per voi risplende il fato. Con i lampi e procelle non voltraggino mai la carapace, né giunga a profanarvi austro rapace.
Victor Young has made a delightful arrangement of Jerome Kern's current hit, Long Ago and Far Away. Now, a song which has been very successful in my concert repertoire. I recorded it some time ago, and it seems to be a favorite with many of you. It's called Sailor Men. Here we go down in our ship to the sea, Donald and John, me. Hoist the anchor and ship the sail. Maybe we'll sight a Greenland whale or meet a giant octopus. It'll frighten you, but it won't scare us. For Donald's as brave can be. And John is just as brave as he. And I am as brave as John. See the big ship we're sailing on, me and Donald and John. We're going to fill her with pirate gold and diamonds and nickels in the hold. Pirates make such a dreadful fuss. They'll frighten you, but they can't scare us. For Donald's the bravest sailor at sea. And John is just as brave as he. And I am as brave as John. Back we sail when the moon's in the sky. Donald and John die. Life at sea is dangerous and hard when your ship is a box and the sea's the backyard. And sailors get tired when they're little like me. And Donald's as sleepy as sleepy can be. John is just as sleepy as he.
And I am as sleepy as
Ken Darby has gone back into the limbo of folk music for his arrangement today, the perennial Kerry Dance, and the lovely old Welsh song, The Ash Grove.
Oh, the days of the Kerry dancing, oh, the ring of the piper's tune. Oh, from one of those hours of gladness gone away like our youth too soon. When the boys began to gather in the glen of a summer night, and the Kerry piper's tuning made us long with wild delight. Oh, the days of the Kerry dancing, oh, the ring of the piper's tune. Oh, for one of those hours of gladness gone away like our youth too soon.
It seems that among the hobbies of our Nesbitt is that of designing homes. This is particularly interesting in the light of the fact that his story today deals with the skyline of tomorrow.
On the night of October 14th, 1940, the city of London nearly died. For cities, like the men who build them, can be wounded to death, can die, and can be reborn. That night, London was near its deathbed, and one man said, it was as if a giant hand had burst through the crust of the earth to hell and was pouring sheets of flame over us. In England, that night will never be forgotten, for not since the Great Fire of 1666 has everything they loved in splendid, gloomy old London been threatened with so certain a death. And now a curious thing happened. That winter the blitzkrieg faltered, and by next spring the crisis had passed forever. And groups of men appeared, crawling like monkeys among the wreckage of London, mapping and drawing pictures and plotting and designing. Their faces were not mournful, they were delighted. For these men were planning a new city to rise from the ruins of so much of London. The men who are planning the cities of tomorrow had come into their own at last. In the month of May 1941, they began to notice an amazing thing that was happening deep down in the bomb craters. Remarkable flowers were growing there, from the puddles of rust-red water up through the piles of shattered glass. And extraordinary vines were twisting up the sides of the pits. Now, what startled the expert planners, and many were trained landscape specialists, was that none of them could recognize the flowers. They took specimens to the Botanical Center at Kew Gardens and began searching the dictionaries for descriptions. Finally, in old texts, 100 and more years of age, they found them. Pictures of more than 90 varieties of flowers that had become extinct in the modern world. It seems that the nitrates from the German bombs had seeped into the soil and become food. The deep pits reached old levels of London of the past and exposed dormant seeds to germination. Their roots fed upon the chemicals from the deadly bombs. And after centuries of sleep, they awakened again. To many people in London, the fun of discovering these lost flowers, though, lay in the fact that they seemed to symbolize a new and living city, rising up from the craters of destruction to live again. And they were quite right. Although no brilliant new city is worth the life of a single human child who has died so dreadfully beneath the bombing raids, disaster can breed great and beautiful change. Here at home, the lightning has not struck our cities, and we're thankful. But over many of them, a slow senility and suicide had been creeping for years. Some of them are strangling themselves with traffic. You see, we planned our cities for the horse and buggy. Hence, you had to live near to your work, and that meant tiny houses close together, row after row. The horse and buggy averaged perhaps 6 miles an hour. The automobile can easily do 50, so that to live 20 miles from your work is already easy and practical where highways are good. And while it was once necessary to live almost next door to the factory or the office in order to get there in reasonable time. And it is this tremendous increase in the speed with which a man can move around that is the key to the city of tomorrow. They will not seem bigger and taller, but instead they will be like a lot of little villages with parks and speedways connecting together, all circled around but hidden from big sources of cheap power, the electric plants and the factories and the waterways and the railroad centers and the airfields. Sure, there's been a lot of talk about plastic houses and glass swimming pools and super futuristic love nests where you can drop your private helicopter down on the roof and then go inside and eat 3 concentrated vitamin pellets and finish up your evening by watching a 3-dimensional color television show. But the men who plan the cities of tomorrow are no more concerned with that notion than they are with Buck Rogers' next rocket ship in the funnies. First of all, they just want to give us room to breathe and sunlight and privacy and nursery schools where a young mother can leave her baby under scientific care for a few hours each morning while she shops and does her housework. And health centers and gymnasiums and 10 miles the amount of green fields and parks and playgrounds that we allow in our cities today. And that sounds simple, doesn't it? And yet it's going to be one of the hardest tasks and struggles that Americans have ever attempted. Certainly, if you live in a modern city tomorrow, you will find it cleaner and greener and safer. And it has taken the dimouts and blackouts of this war to bring home to many of us what a priceless thing just light can be. Not long ago in the Middle West, they were planning a beautiful and large church with a great expensive tower to point up to the heavens and symbolize man's search for God. And then, before they built it, a famous American architect said, "Why build a tower of granite when we can now throw a great tower of light miles into the skies?" And that is the way it was finally done, a tower of light instead of a tower of stone. And at this hour, smashed piles of stone that once were cities are dotting the plains and valleys of Europe. But tomorrow, out of the rubble, the new cities will rise. And if we can use all of the new knowledge that has come to us, these cities can really be the beacon lights of a happier age to come in history's passing parade.
Thank you, John Nesbitt. You've heard Tiger Rag played in every which way, I'm sure. But Vic Young has made a symphonic arrangement of it now that's really something. Vic, let's hear it. Marching Song of Freedom. From New York to San Diego, all across the USA, from Dakota's furrowed plains to teeming wharves in Mobile Bay, our mighty millions thunder this battle hymn today.
Our voices span the ocean and resound across the land, to England's shores and China's fields and Russia's vast expanse.
A pledge to freedom's host, to weld our minds, our hearts, our need into a mighty steel strong deed to crush the fascist hope. To the fight, all men who'd be free, let us speed the hour of victory. Millions of hands in mills, in mines, heeding the call of the battle line.
A cavalcade through freedom's gates, the ships, the tanks, the P-38.
We've only begun. We're in the fight till victory is won, till the banner of freedom triumphant's unfurled and the people are free all around the world.
The fight we've only begun.
We're in the fight
till the victory is won.
People are free on our own.
sir. That was La Cucaracha. Well, dear friends, we've sung our last song until our next visit with you 1 week from now. You know, Vic and Ken and I especially enjoy getting letters from you service men and women, and if you have a song or musical selection you would like to hear, just drop us a line. We'll do our best to oblige. Address your letters to Armed Forces Radio, Los Angeles, USA. So until next week at this same time, this is John Charles Thomas saying goodbye and God bless.
This is the Armed Forces Radio Service.